Next case is State versus Carrasco Zelaya. Apologize if I mispronounce that. You may approach.
Your Honor, counsel, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Campbell, and I represent Mr. Carrasco, who was previously convicted of motor vehicle homicide. Now, before I get into the argument specifically, it is worth noting what the evidence in this case was and what it was not. Critical, in fact, to one particular witness. Beginning with the scene, a deceased individual, no other eyewitnesses of how the scene came to be, i.e. skid marks on the street, body where it is, shoes 10 feet approximately from the body, and this is what we have. Now, a vehicle was later found that Mr. Carrasco was driving, and there was, as I would say, the evidence of drops, not large amounts, no hand or anything, drops of what appeared to be some DNA, perhaps blood. The testimony was slightly inconclusive. They didn't know what it really was. It was just a little bit of DNA underneath the vehicle. How that DNA got to this location is of paramount importance. This case, then, is about certain irregularities that deprived the defendant of a fair trial. One witness in particular, Mr. Cassidis, testified how this DNA got to its location. That is of paramount importance because there's no other real way to connect the crime scene with the individual, the defendant. The defendant was found approximately an hour or two after seen leaving the bar in the vehicle. In between that time, there's basically a complete void: who, what, where, when the scene is found, and then later the defendant is found. So this witness is of paramount importance. The irregularities began when I informed the court that this witness did not understand what the court was saying, and any court orders is important, and I felt that it should be given to the individual. I knew what his testimony was as a defense witness before it had happened. I asked the court permission to tell him. The judge said, no, I could not. I believe it came up twice. The individual was pointed from the room, the witness. He left literally not knowing anything. He doesn't speak any English. He testified later in Spanish. No dispute there. He leaves not knowing anything. Later, when it comes up, the state immediately moves to strike his entire testimony because it came out that he had had a phone call or a couple phone calls with the defendant. He testified not about the case per se, but I believe it's his stepbrother.
How much later did it come up?
When he testified.
And how many days after the trial started was that?
If memory serves, it was one or two. And on one day, we went even until 6 p.m.
And when were the phone calls between the brother, the defendant and the stepbrother? When did they occur?
I do not know. The state never offered evidence of that. It came up at trial. The state mentioned they were going to look at the records to get proof of what they had alleged.
And
the state never did, so I don't know.
I assume that there were breaks during the course of that first day of trial.
Oh, of course. There was, a morning break and an afternoon, a lunch break.
So there were opportunities to visit with this witness at that time about the meaning of the sequestration work.
In hindsight, most definitely. Your Honor's question is, I think, perfect. The judge even brought it up later, where he said, I understand you're a sole practitioner. The judge even addressed that. You probably wouldn't have had time. You knew how busy you were. And honestly, I was just in the trial. I wasn't necessarily thinking about some event that had passed. I need to move on. Also, I will note, the individual left the courthouse. He was not there. He wasn't in the hallways. He wasn't there. I told him, I don't know when you're going to testify because I didn't know when the state would end. So it's a big deal because when it came up later, the judge made every decision basically upon that, on that moment. Now it's important to note that the state or the Attorney General's office will note that this is about credibility. Because if it's just about credibility and a fact finder, then this case will be simply affirmed. I submit to the court now that it's not about a mere credibility of a fact finder. This is about a previous error of the court wherein a witness would have been notified had I been allowed to explain the court's order. On the conclusion of the case, the judge mentioned they had been talking. On the motion for new trial, he mentioned they had been specifically talking. The judge brought it up multiple times, obviously in his mind at the time. And the problem is, it came up because I perceived the court's error. In other cases, I've never been told that I couldn't tell a witness a court's order.
So was there evidence as to when these conversations occurred?
Do you mean the phone calls?
The phone calls.
No, there wasn't.
So we don't know if those phone calls happened during the course of trial?
Honestly, we don't. The state, as we previously discussed, the state brought it up, but they never followed up on what they said. In the record, it specifically says, when did they occur, or the jail, whatever. And Mr. Lindbergh, the prosecutor, said he was going to go to the jail and get him. He never did. It never came up later. So I honestly don't know when they occurred, and I don't know if they ever occurred. Testimony was, we didn't discuss what I would testify to. And when he was asked, did you know? He said, no, I had no idea. I couldn't talk to this person. So, again, the problem
and
for
who
me...
And was that the defendant or the witness?
My apologies. The witness, Mr. Kostadis, when he was cross-examined, he was asked, did you know you couldn't talk to, in this case, the witnesses or the defendant? Mm-hmm. He said, no, I had no idea. And so this case is distinguishable from a case, well, several cases that the state cites, wherein the prosecutor or someone, for example, stating this line, when the prosecutor or someone says something and it's not objected to, this is different because the judge essentially began the whole situation. I'm not sure how I could object. The judge knew my opinion. I hate to say, judge, one moment, please. Can I tell him? He said no. I guess I could object after object. At some point, I didn't want to
lack respect. Could you file a motion to recuse? Or was there something else you could have done at that point or should have done?
Judge, perhaps a motion for mistrial. However, again, in hindsight, I didn't know what the future. This issue hadn't even formally come out. I couldn't give them an order from the court that hadn't yet occurred, and so in the past when I published on it, and so if you were interpreted there, or I can spend I talked to them, the courts always say yes. This was very odd, and he said no. I didn't want to object to real lack of respect, and in my opinion, obviously, I said, I mean, no. I didn't know the future would come up later.
If the court, though, was, if it wasn't an issue of credibility, would not the court have granted the motion to strike?
Judge, that is something that I thought about, and I don't necessarily have an answer. There appeared to be some confusion, because when this came up, the court went back and forth about how it was a close call, time to talk to the individual, and then the court mentions bias, but then keeps bringing up the facts that we're talking, so it's just about credibility and bias. Honestly, I don't have the answer to that. The court seemed to go back and forth, but kept bringing up the fact that they were talking. So, to my next point, essentially, bias in this case, there were other points in time during testimony wherein how did certain items get on the bottom of the car, blood, alleged feces, whatever, and I was not allowed to probe this from the witnesses, wherein the state kept objecting to relevance. The relevance is the state witnesses, these officers or the investigative team had no idea how anything got on the bottom of the vehicle. At one point there was a hair that was there, she couldn't even see that. So I wasn't even allowed to probe all the, essentially bias. How does your opinion come to this? You're saying it's feces, but you have no evidence as to how. and the state kept objecting, and I wasn't even allowed to go further. We had a sidebar at one point about this, and then the conclusion of the court, again, was back on bias and this individual, the witness talking. So in summary, several inconsistencies that I perceived gave rise to certain errors that I didn't think were normal. I hadn't seen this before, and had the court not essentially created the error in the first place, I don't believe we'd be here today, or at least we'd have further evidence that could be allowed to understand how the blood got on the bottom of the vehicle, which essentially connected my client to the crime scene.
I know you're out of time. I have just one other question. Was there some evidence that the defendant had indicated he did not leave the bar with the victim, but the video surveillance showed otherwise?
There was a tremendous amount of evidence as to certain statements, and I believe that was an issue that had come up. However, it was not. It came up at some point, yes.
Did he make that statement at the police station?
I believe he did. However, the fact that he had been drinking was not in, at least I never raised that issue. He was drunk, and that was essentially admitted. So he made the statement. However, I don't know if that is per se an issue, but yes.
Thank you.
How far did we take him over? Okay, let's add that to the state's time, please. Morning, Mr. List.
Good morning, Mr. Rhodes. May it please the Court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. There are two overarching issues in this appeal. Number one, whether the district court erred in the handling of Marlon Becerra's testimony, and number two, whether the district court erred in not allowing the defense to explore issues of bias, but allowing the state to do the same. We maintain that the appellant is not entitled to relief on either issue. As far as the first issue regarding the trial court's handling of Ronald Caceres' testimony, just briefly as a factual matter in response to questions during the appellant's argument, the record does reflect that those phone calls took place during trial. Ronald Caceres himself testified that there were four or five phone calls that had taken place between he and the defendant since trial began, so the record does reflect that. As far as our response is set forth in our brief, just as an initial matter, we question whether this issue was preserved, at least to the extent the appellant's claiming that the trial court improperly excluded evidence. But in any event, to the extent this issue has preserved, has been preserved, we submit that it's nonetheless not merit because the trial court did not err in handling the Ronald Caceres' testimony. Contrary to the appellant's assertion, the trial court did not exclude Mr. Caceres' testimony and actually admit his testimony despite the sequestration violation. It just found that his testimony was incredible, given his demeanor, his eye contact, his response to questions in trial. In fact, he spoke with the defendant in violation of the sequestration. This is a finding of fact, and there was nothing improper or erroneous with that finding.
If it was error, though, for the court not to allow the witness to be told about the order, the fact that the court then later relies upon a violation of that order,
Well, first of all, I would say that I'm not aware of any authority that would indicate that it was error for the court not to allow that to happen at that time and place. But even if it is error, I think we have to look at what harm or prejudice is caused by that. I mean, so that there was none, given that the defense had ample time to communicate this to the witness, despite the fact that they weren't allowed to do so immediately. The fact that they did not do so is not the court's fault. Plus, as the record reflects, and as I noted in my brief, it was Mr. Carrasco-Zelaya himself that initiated the phone calls to Mr. Caceres and created the actual sequestration violation. So to the extent there's any problem with Mr. Caceres not knowing about the sequestration order, it was the defendant who created the sequestration violation. That's certainly not the court's fault. There's no prejudice here. Certainly none due to the state or to the court. If there's any harm created here, it was done by the defendant himself. But beyond that, to answer your question, Judge, I don't think, to the extent the court considered that would be improper. I mean, whether you have a sequestration order or not, that's something that a court could consider, or any finder of fact could consider, in looking at whether or not a witness is credible. Even if you don't have a sequestration order, you find out that a witness is speaking with the defendant or other witnesses during trial. I mean, that's something you can certainly look at and say, well, I think you lack credibility, but maybe you're speaking with these people in trial. So I don't see any error in that regard. And we would maintain that the assignments of error regarding the handling of all of the assessment here without merit. If there are no further questions on that, I will briefly address the second overarching issue pertaining to the trial court's alleged disparate rulings regarding bias. Set forth in our brief, we would submit that this issue is not preserved for appeal because it was not raised in trial during the witnesses in question. As far as the testimony of Molly Reel, the state objected to Carrasco's and Elias' questions of her on the basis of relevance, and that was the objection that was sustained. The state did not object on bias, and Carrasco's Elias was not questioning her regarding bias. So the issue of bias simply didn't come up during her testimony, and we submit that issue is not before you. As far as the testimony of Officer Neva, Mr. Carrasco's Elias claims the trial court erred by not allowing him to cross-examine Neva about the issue of bias, but then subsequently allowing the state to cross-examine Ronald Caceres about bias, which he claims resulted in disparate treatment and an unfair trial. As noted in our brief, though, he did not object to the state's questions. Those questions from the state to Ronald Caceres were completely unchallenged. So there simply was no disparate rulings or no disparate treatment here. He didn't bring the issue up. So the trial court didn't rule on it. There was no disparity. So we maintain that the assignments of error pertaining that issue regarding bias is not properly before the court. If there are no further questions, then we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. My understanding is the appellant is out of time. We got him over there. Thank you. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it. We will take the case under advisement.